Chapter 3. The Lorik Museum of Exploration is a white brick building that looks mostly untouched. Whoever is attacking us must not think of it as being a worthy target. As I race up the stone steps, I wonder what I'm going to do if Sophie isn't here. What if she ran into some of those monsters and didn't make it past them? Thinking about Sophie lying crumpled on the street makes me cringe in a way I wouldn't have expected. We're not close, but she was kind to me at a time when I had all but sworn off everyone in Capital City, and for that, I guess I have some sentimental attachment to her. I grimace, steeling myself. This is no time to be getting caught up in emotions. I need to stay strong and focused. One of the tall glass doors to the museum opens when I approach, and it's only when I'm inside and Sophie is closing it behind me that I realize it's because she was there waiting for me. I breathe a sigh of relief.
"Lexa,"
she says, stepping forward. She looks like she's about to hug me, but I hold out a hand instead. She pauses, and then takes it, wrapping her fingers around it. Her curly red hair is pulled back into a tight bun, one strand falling haphazardly over her face.
"What the hell is happening?" I ask.
"Invasion," she says, "on a global scale."
"Who?"
"I saw some..."
I struggle to find the right word.
"Monsters.
They murdered a woman, but the guard showed up and took them out."
Sophie nods, her eyes looking distant.
"Those guard were lucky then. I saw some fighting on my way here too, but there were so many of the invaders. Armies of them, with beasts and weapons like I've never seen. The guard were trying to defend some children, and..."
She doesn't finish.
"Why are we here?" I ask. "Is there a bunker? Some kind of shelter we can hide in?"
"Bunker?"
Sophie asks, her eyebrows forming a line of confusion across her forehead.
"There is no bunker. There's only the ship. You're flying us out of here."
My mouth hangs open as I try to wrap my head around this.
"What?"
I ask.
The idea is unfathomable to me. The ship Sophie's talking about is the one she'd hired me to work on, refurbishing the vessel to the state it would have been in when it was in use generations ago. But it was never actually meant to be flown. It runs on fossil fuel, something our society hasn't used in ages.
"Impossible," I say.
"Not impossible."
She shakes her head.
"It's our only way of getting out of here. The elders, they don't expect the Lorik to survive this. And even if we do, you saw those invaders, Lexa. Do you want to be under their rule?"
"Where do you expect us to go?"
"Earth," she says. "It's the closest inhabitable planet."
I know about this planet. When I was at the Academy, I was on a team that specialized in modifying and upgrading technologies for Earth, a place we had been helping to advance and evolve for centuries. They had us to thank for several of their breakthroughs over the centuries. I can't believe Sophie is telling me that this planet that is so far behind ours in every conceivable way is our only hope for survival.
"There's no way," I say. "What would we even use for fuel?"
"You remember Raylan, the man who commissioned the ship restoration?"
Sophie steps towards the glass doors, looking out warily.
"Well, in order to receive his funding, the museum had to follow his very specific instructions. Part of that meant storing a tankard of synthetic fossil fuels in the display room. We all thought he was crazy. I mean, for the longest time he was living as a hermit in that huge compound. But maybe he was thinking farther ahead than any of us could. I've heard that he's a descendant of one of the elders. Who knows? Maybe he knew this was going to happen."
Sophie starts to wring her hands. I try to process everything that's happening.
"But there's a catch," she says, turning back to me. "Per Raylan's instructions, the fuel pump can only be accessed through a passcode, one only he knows. He contacted me right before communications went out, asking me to oversee preparations. He was having trouble getting in contact with his pilot at the LDC,
I told him I knew someone who could fly the rocket, but I wanted a place on the ship. He agreed. He's on his way now. Once he gets here, we can fuel up and go.
I stare back at her, still not believing anything I'm hearing.
Please, she says, I can't fly this thing. You're the only one I trust to get us out of here alive. You know this ship. Even if you hadn't been on the refurbishing team, I know you used to program flight sims back at the academy. Those included older models like this, right?
That was years ago, I say.
I'm not a pilot. Call your brother.
Her brother, Janus, is a hotshot pilot for the Lorian Defense Council. She shakes her head.
I did. He's been called out on a miss.
Then call the LDC or the LDA.
Call.
I struggle to come up with another viable option.
There's no one else, she says.
Her voice is firm, but her hands are trembling.
I talked to my brother.
She swallows hard.
He said these attacks were strategic. They've taken out our weapons, our ships, anything that's left is being used to fight. They've hit us hard. The ports, the academy. This is likely the only flyable passenger ship left in Capital City. If we don't leave...
She trails off, but I get the point. It's easy to see our situation. She doesn't believe this world is going to survive. Lorien. Perfect Lorien. With its green forests and red-peaked mountains, and elders who always know what's best for us. This false utopia is going to burn.
Besides, I've seen you fly before.
I wince. That was different, I say. An accident. Besides, the only reason I got off the ground was because I was in a ship where almost every function was automated. Not like this ancient piece of crap you're suggesting we use.
Lex.
I stare into her big, pleading green eyes for what feels like a long time, but I say nothing. My mind is too overrun with the images of what I saw between my apartment and the museum. Everything Lorien has already lost. Everything I've lost. My home. My work. My brother. And now I stand in front of the only person I might consider a friend. And she's asking me to leave our world behind. Lorien, which I've been fighting to change. But it is changed now. It can never be the same. And I realize that if I do go with her, all I'd be leaving behind is a planet, not a home or family. My options are to try to escape or die fighting for a place that I had already grown to hate.
There's more to it. Zophie says softly. There are others going. There's another ship that's leaving. It may have already left. We have to join it. Janus is piloting it.
The doors burst open before I can respond. A small floating trolley piled high with boxes and bags sails in. A dozen or so chimerae follow behind it. And finally, a man. He's tall with dark curly hair and thick eyebrows. His pale blue shirt is ringed with sweat.
Creighton!
Zophie exclaims, rushing to close the doors behind him.
Where are Raylan and Arina? Are they...
They're staying, Creighton says. They're guard. They're going to fight. Zophie's mouth hangs open for a few moments. Then she just nods. Who's this? The man asks, staring at me.
Our pilot,
Zophie says, looking at me in a way that makes it obvious that she wants me to keep my mouth shut and just go along with her.
Lexa, this is Creighton. He's a caretaker at Raylan's estate. You may remember seeing him making deliveries to the museum when you were here. He's been our go-between with Raylan for years.
What is all this? I ask. Supplies. He says, waving to the boxes. Food, weapons, water, medicine. Even some bags of jewelry and valuables to barter with. Raylan had it all loaded up and ready to go at a moment's notice. I think he'd been anticipating something like this.
I meant the Chimerae.
They're coming with us.
His voice gets quiet.
There were more of them when we left the estate. They fought bravely to make sure we got here.
I'm about to protest the idea of taking an animal horde on board the already small ship, not to mention the fact that I don't even know if I can fly it, when Zophie steps forward.
We need a passcode to access the fuel, she says. Did he give it to you?
Yes,
Creighton nods.
It's her name.
My head buzzes with confusion. Creighton shifts his weight, turning slightly. And that's when I realize that he's not just carrying a backpack. There's something moving inside the bag strapped to him, stretching beneath the dusty layer of fabric covering his pack and starting to fuss as if just waking up. A baby. I must look surprised, because Creighton nods his head back over his shoulder.
Her name is Ella. That's the passcode. I watched Raylan change it on his data pad right before I left. Something simple so I'd remember it.
Zophie pulls back the cloth covering the baby. She's tiny, pink, and wrinkled. I haven't had much experience with babies, but she looks too small, like a doll.
She's so tiny,
Zophie whispers, almost cooing.
Everything happened very fast, Creighton says. Arina wasn't feeling well, and then suddenly she was in labor. No time to trek into the city. But everything was fine. Arina and Raylan looked so happy. Then the sky turned red and everything went wrong. They entrusted her to me. I don't think they believe this is something they will survive. I have to make sure she's safe. It's bad out there, Zophie. If they don't make it, their sacrifice can't have been in vain.
There's an explosion outside. Close. Too close. Dust and debris fall from the ceiling around us.
We have to move, Creighton says.
This way.
Zophie pulls on his sleeve.
Hurry!
Chapter 4. We throw on ill-fitting spacesuits pulled out of an exploration exhibit, slipping them on over our own clothes. They're supposed to help with the changing pressures as we exit the atmosphere, but I'm more concerned that the refurbished ship holds together through liftoff at all. Besides, if we get to a point where a spacesuit is the only thing keeping us alive, we're probably dead already. The ship is housed inside a cavernous domed exhibit, alone in the center of the stone floor. Zophie and I enter the room first, followed by the herd of Chimerae, and finally Creighton, who drags Raylan's supplies on the floating lift. All three of us start shouting orders at the same time, trying to figure out what to do, caught up in the madness and fear of what's happening. I slip into a hyperproductive stupor, opening the ship's main loading hatch and grabbing the first of many boxes. Interactive panels line the walls of the room, detailing the primitive nature of old vessels like ours. How inefficient and poisonous fossil fuel was before we switched to synthetics, and then eventually the power crystals we use now. Zophie taps on one of the displays a few times, and it slides away, revealing a fuel pump. She plugs it into the ship, and then joins Creighton and me as we load supplies as fast as we can.
Can't these damned Chimerae help at all? I ask. Feel free to ask them, Creighton says. Not that they'll understand you. Besides, they're scared.
I'm scared, Zophie says, her breath heaving as she somehow manages to lift a box that must weigh as much as she does up to me inside the ship. I've never wished I had telekinesis more than I do right now.
When the supplies are taken care of, the Chimerae flood in, shrinking into smaller animals. They flank the sides of the cargo hold as I rush down the narrow hallway that leads to the cockpit, past the small private rooms, galley, and common area. In the pilot's seat, I pause for a few moments as I try to recall the countless hours I'd spent inside this ship, helping to repair its systems. But I've crammed a lot of information into my brain since then. I think back to all the old guides and books I'd read and simulations I'd programmed. My fingers start pressing buttons and flipping switches. By some miracle, I manage to get the ship powered on.
We're ready,
Zophie says as she appears beside me, taking a seat in the co-pilot's chair and buckling herself in. Creighton drops into a seat behind her, the swaddling backpack spun around so that the baby is in front of him.
Everybody, hold on.
I press a few more buttons. The loading door closes, and the ship tilts up, pushing us back in our seats. From the cockpit, we stare at the roof of the domed room, which is only a foot away from the nose of the ship.
I'm guessing this thing's not retractable, I say.
Zophie shakes her head. She reaches out a hand and grasps my upper arm. A bead of sweat runs from my forehead down the side of my nose, stinging my eye.
I guess we're about to find out how good a job we did of refurbishing this thing.
Zophie squeezes my arm. Let's do this. I flip a switch, and it feels like I've just detonated a bomb. Fire fills the room. The craft shakes so hard that I'm sure it's going to fall apart, ending our journey before it ever begins. But it doesn't, miraculously. Instead, we punch through the ceiling. The thick glass of the dome shatters, exploding out into the red night sky, glittering as it catches the light from the flames around us. We're up in the air. The cockpit offers a sweeping view of Capital City, and even though I'm focused on the control panels and onboard monitors, I can see how widespread the damage to Lorien is. Fire and smoke fill the horizon. On our right, a beam of purple light shoots down from the sky beyond the outskirts of the city. I don't know if it's a herald or something far more ominous. From the air, many parts of the city are unrecognizable, smoldering scars where vibrant neighborhoods once stood. There's something strange about the skyline, too, but I don't figure out what it is until I realize that we should be flying past the spires of Elkin. But they're gone. The structures that held a third of our city's people have been obliterated. I go numb. I can't look at it anymore. My focus shifts solely to the instruments in front of me.
It's gone, Zophie whispers. Our planet, our home.
Our trajectory has more of an arc to it than it should, and I pull on the flight yoke, desperately trying to keep the ship's nose up. The sky is too dark, full of smoke from our burning city, but the ship presses on, and we punch through the haze. It's only then that we can see the enemy warships, jagged and gray, countless in number, firing on our planet. Smaller ships shuttle down to the surface. In the middle is a pearly sphere, floating like a dim moon that the other vehicles orbit.
How can this be happening? Creighton asks.
We shoot past the fleet. By some luck, our course sent us through a hole in their formation, and then we're jetting into the blackness of space. Despite the ship's primitive nature, I have to admit, it's fast, at least on takeoff. And just like that, in the course of a few minutes, we've made it. We've left Lorien behind. I tap on the radar screens, trying to make sure no one's following us, but I don't see anything. Once I figure out how to set the artificial gravity in autopilot, I finally allow myself to breathe. Creighton bounces the baby in his arms and whispers shaky reassurances to her, but his eyes are wide and watery.
By the elders,
Zophie mutters. She leans forward in her seat, staring out into space.
Where's the other ship? Can you find it?
It takes a little while to navigate the controls, but eventually I figure out how to expand the radar's search. I'm getting a Lorik signature from a ship that appears to have stopped some distance from the planet, I say, but it's a weak signal. We're so far away from it already.
Turn back.
She starts to nod.
Head towards it. We'll travel to Earth together.
After swiping through a few galaxy maps, I find Earth. Various figures start to populate the cockpit screens.
I don't think we can.
I stare at the instrument panels in front of me,
doing calculations in my head. It's too far away from us right now, and we barely have enough fuel to get to Earth as it is. We're going to have to rely on momentum more than I would want to already. Unless you know of a fueling station somewhere between here and there. Besides, we were lucky to escape unharmed. Turning back around and getting close to those enemy ships again could be suicide.
Then contact the other ship,
Zophie says, an edge to her voice.
They'll be operating on an emergency channel, or maybe the official council channel. I'm not—
We can't, I say.
What are you talking about?
Those alien ships might intercept the transmission, Creighton says. What if they use it to follow us?
We're in a giant white rocket that just shot into the sky, Zophie shouts. We didn't exactly make a subtle exit.
We can't, I say louder. The baby in Creighton's arms wakes up. We can't contact them because this ship was refurbished to be an exact replica of the older models, meaning its communication systems were never upgraded. Their ship runs on a completely different comm system. Zophie starts to say something, but instead lets out a whimper. The baby begins to shriek. Creighton looks back and forth between us, confused.
So, what does that mean?
He asks. I turn to one of the port windows. In the distance, Lorien burns. Our world is weeping fire and smoke and death. And for a moment, memories flash through my head. Happier times long since passed. Chasing my brother through lush green fields, laughing over home-cooked meals. The faces of people I haven't thought of in years. It's so overwhelming that I have to swallow down the urge to cry, or be sick, or scream. In all my years of hating Lorien and the way it was run, I never expected to see it like this. I wanted to change the planet, not watch it be destroyed. It means we're alone, I say. Creighton stares at the floor.
We left them, he says quietly. We left everyone to die.
He starts to mutter names and then apologies. Tears stream down his cheeks. Zophie isn't crying, though. Her eyes look out into space, searching for something, but finding only stars and planets and other celestial bodies light years away, and a cold, black expanse of emptiness. I tap on the instruments again, confirming our course, breathing out a sigh of relief to find that the navigational system I helped to reinstall is actually working. But that's the last of the good news.
You've got to be kidding me,
I mutter.
What is it?
Zophie asks.
We made a fast start, but it cost us a lot of fuel.
Right?
Zophie says, bracing for bad news.
Which means it's going to be a long flight, I say. How long?
Creighton asks. I turn back to the control panel, staring at the number on the screen in front of me.
About 1.5 years, I say.
Chapter 5. Creighton finds some pillows and puts Ella down for a nap in a pulled-out drawer in one of the private rooms. Afterwards, we sit on benches in the little common area beside the galley and go over the events of the last hour so many times that they begin to feel unreal, like an old myth told to scare children into doing their chores. I have to keep reminding myself that every word spoken is true. I think we're all in shock. I know I am.
All those ships, Creighton says. Those bastards.
Who were they? I ask. What were they? When they were wounded, they just disintegrated. Zophie narrows her eyes, staring at the ground. I recognize this look from the days at the museum when she would work out complicated problems in her head, or try to figure out how we were going to get vintage wiring and fixtures for the refurbishment. Back when the rocket was just a project I was working on for some money, and not the only thing keeping me alive.
What is it?
I ask.
Well,
her nose crinkles a little.
There were always rumors at the museum of an old conflict between us and another planet. Tales archivists and historians told when too many ampules had been passed around at parties. There was no hard evidence to substantiate these stories, but there were hints that there was some truth in the claims, telling gaps in our historical record, and allusions to terrible casualties and vicious otherworldly beings found in diaries and letters. We couldn't help but speculate.
You're talking about the Mogadorians,
Creighton says. She seems a little surprised that he knows the word.
It means nothing to me.
And yet I feel as though I've heard it or seen it before,
in encrypted messages I didn't think were important, or whispered in the halls of LDA when I was there so long ago.
Raylan talked about them often,
Creighton says.
He had all these theories about secret wars, just like you described. He was sure that his father had been not only a key figure in the conflict between us and the Mogadorians, but an elder, and that there was some sort of conspiracy that led to the number of elders being reduced to 9.
Creighton shakes his head.
Raylan's claims changed all the time, but he was obsessed with trying to prove them. I always thought he was a little crazy, but this is crazy.
Zophie keeps nodding.
There were whispers that Raylan's father had been a traitor to the Lorik, she says. Again, there's no hard evidence there even was a secret war. But Raylan had probably heard these rumors at some point or another. I think it's one of the reasons he was so keen on donating money to the museum and getting this ship rebuilt. He wanted to show that his family was doing something positive for the people of Lorien.
That's all well and good, I say. But what else do we know about these Mogadorians?
Zophie lays it out for us, everything she's heard during her time at the museum. According to rumors and legends, generations ago, the Lorik reached out to the planet Mogador, trying to form diplomatic bonds with the planet. But their civilizations were barbaric and not ready for contact with more advanced beings. Something happened there. The details vague and sometimes contradictory, depending on who was telling the story. But from what Zophie could gather, many Lorik lost their lives during the expedition, and subsequently, all contact with the planet and its people was forbidden. We try to digest this. Eventually, we sit in silence, none of us knowing what to say. None of us sure how to react to the fact that our planet might be completely obliterated by these monsters. My thoughts race as I try to make sense of all this, piecing together a bigger picture of what happened. I think back to the message I'd intercepted earlier, about the airstrip, the prophecy. The evacuation, I say. Do you know who is on the other ship?
Janus wasn't supposed to say anything, Zophie says. It was highly confidential. He was breaking his highest oaths by telling me.
I understand, I say, but it's not like the information is going to go past this rocket.
Her shoulders sag. She relents.
I don't know much. Something about 9 chosen guard. The elders assemble them, or Laridas alone, I'm not sure. They, along with their Sepans, are the ones in the other ship. They're the last hope.
For what?
Creighton asks.
For the survival of our people.
Zophie smiles a sad little smile.
Well, other than us, I guess. I don't know why they were chosen, but that's what Jaina said. They're going to be blessed with something. Maybe they already have been. Some charm to protect them. It sounds crazy, I know. Why would the elders try to save a handful of us while the rest of the planet is sacrificed?
I clench my jaw. Of course this is how they faced the planet's destruction. By using us. By treating us as pawns as they always have.
That can't be right,
Creighton says.
It is, I say. Right before the first wave of attacks,
I intercepted a message sent out to 9 Mentor Se Pons, telling them something about meeting at an airstrip, that the prophecy was coming true. The elders abandoned the rest of us.
That's insane, Creighton says. What are these 9 supposed to do on Earth? Everything I know about that planet sounds like it's far inferior to Lorien.
It could be worse, Zophie says. We could be headed to Mogador.
Creighton opens his mouth to say something else, but the baby starts to cry again. He excuses himself and heads down the hall to tend to her.
I guess we have to get used to that sound, Zophie says.
She stands.
I'm gonna start taking stock of our supplies. We'll need to ration, and I need to do something with my hands right now. Anything.
A question has been circulating through my mind. Why did you ask me to come with you? I'm still trying to fit everything together. Surely there was someone else, someone in the department who studied this damned relic. Why me?
You got us up here, didn't you?
It's going to be a long flight if we're keeping secrets the whole time, Zophie.
Because I knew you wouldn't want to stay and fight,
she says finally.
There was no time to argue with anyone about what our duty was. I don't know exactly what you've been doing for the last few years, but I knew, even when you were working at the museum, how unhappy you were with Lorien and its leaders. Not that I blame you after what's happened.
I stare up at her, not saying anything for a little while. I don't know how I'm supposed to feel about any of this. And you? I ask. Why didn't you stay and fight? She turns away from me, staring out one of the portholes.
My parents died last year. Janus is the only family I have. I thought we'd be able to talk to the other ship. I thought...
She wipes a tear from one of her eyes.
I was stupid. Everything happened so fast. As soon as I disconnected from Raylan, I called Janus and told him to meet me at the museum, but he was already being taken to the airstrip. He told me to find shelter. He was going to Earth. I didn't understand. That's when he told me about Loridas and the guard. And then everything was on fire, and I couldn't reach him. I didn't even know where his ship was. At first, I thought he was breaking all his sworn oaths as a member of the LDC by telling me this classified intel. But now I realize he only told me because he assumed I wouldn't survive. He was saying goodbye.
Why didn't he bring you with him? I ask. Zophie shakes her head.
Loridas was there. The LDC was involved. You know how strict they would be about who could be on that ship. Besides, if they made allowances for one person, they'd have to start letting everyone on.
Heaven forbid they protect their people, I mutter.
I had to come, she says. I had to go. I had to follow Janus.
And you needed a pilot who was a shitty citizen and wouldn't have anything to leave behind.
He's my family, Lex, she says, not looking at me. He's all I have. You of all people know how important that makes him to me.
And with one sentence, the already tiny common room seems to shrink around me as I think of my own brother. My chest buzzes and my throat tightens. After all these years, he can still take me by surprise, causing my heart to clench and dragging me down into a deep, palpable hurt. Zophie smiles weakly, unconvincingly.
Earth is 10 times bigger than Lorien, Lex, and it's so different. How am I supposed to find him there?
I stare at the metal floor of the ship, trying to think of something to say, some kind of reassurance. You don't give up faith, I say, even when common sense tells you that you should. She must know I don't believe this, but she does me the favor of not pointing that out. Chapter 6. I explore every inch of the ship, reminding myself of its layout. It doesn't take long, since the rocket is basically just one long hallway. There are 4 small personal rooms, The Chimerae stay at the back of the ship, nesting around the boxes and supplies we brought on board. We're lucky in that, as part of the refurbishment and exhibition, the closets are stocked with clothes, and the galley has some useful tools and appliances. For the next year and a half, we'll be living in a model home, surviving off of Raylan supplies. I find an old data pad in the cockpit, outlining the functions and capabilities of the ship, and show it to Zophie and Creighton. I tell them it's my duty as their pilot to know this ship as well as possible and excuse myself for a few hours, choosing one of the tiny private quarters to call my own. It's cramped and sparsely furnished with a dresser, a chair, and a bed that is 6 inches too short for me. I toss the data pad onto the bed without turning it on and sit in the chair, staring out the dense glass of the porthole window. And I think of him. It's not what I want to do, but it's impossible not to, being out here, flying through space. Zane, my younger brother. There was a time when Zane was a constant, sunny figure in my life. He was a guard who was going to make my grandfather the proudest Lorik on the planet. At least that's what he always said. I remember one morning when he was 8 or 9, sitting around the breakfast table. He suddenly stopped eating, put down his fork, and turned to our grandfather.
"Papa,"
he said, his voice as serious as I'd ever heard it.
"When I grow up, I'm going to be an elder, and if there are already 9 elders, they'll look at me and make me the 10th. I'm going to make our family proud."
I'd stifled a laugh, but my grandfather just nodded and smiled.
"I believe you, Z," he said. "But if you're going to do that, you'll need to start by eating the rest of your breakfast."
When I think back on my life, the shining bright spot is when the two of us were both at the Lorien Defense Academy. He was just a kid, 13 years old, but I was already in my 2nd year as a technology specialist for the LDA, much younger than my classmates. I'd had a knack for electronics that sent me rising through the ranks, allowing me to work on projects other people my age wouldn't have dreamed of being a part of. Stuff like programming simulations and satellite navigations. I even helped tweak a few of our Lorik technologies to be taken to Earth. I thought I'd found my calling. I had no desire to be a mentor Saipan. Aside from Zane, I'd never felt the urge to train or supervise a kid with legacies. But numbers and computer programs made sense to me. I felt at home there, at the LDA, working more hours a day than was probably healthy. I saw Zane often, mostly during meals or when he'd show up in the tech labs wanting to brag about how well he'd done in training. He'd study in the corner while I worked. Sometimes I'd have to wake him up and drag him back to his room when he'd fallen asleep over a book. We seemed like the perfect siblings. Both excelling, both with promising futures ahead of us. Zane was partnered with a Saipan named Dalus, whose qualifications I had questioned from the very beginning. He was too new, too green to be training someone like Zane, who was headstrong and eager to show what he was made of. I didn't think Dalus could handle him. The man was meek, with a quiet voice you had to lean in to hear. I'd spend enough time chasing Zane around our grandfather's house to know that he needed an authoritarian figure keeping him on track. I even complained to the higher-ups at the academy. All they said was that the bond between Guard and Saipan had already been established and that it would be damaging to both of them if they were separated. So were the ways of Lorien. The LDA spoke on behalf of the elders, and whatever the elders said went. There was no room for complaint. And so I tried to accept that the system knew what was best for Zane. That as his older sister, I was maybe overreacting, being too overprotective, caring too much. After Zane developed the legacy of flight during his 2nd year at the academy, I hardly ever saw him with his feet on the ground. Several of the guard could fly, but Zane flew with such grace and speed. It was as if he was teleporting, darting from one end of the campus to the other in the blink of an eye. He was living up to the promises he'd made our family. He was becoming something undeniably special. Dalus saw promise in him too, not just as a pupil, but as something he could exploit. If Zane ended up being the fastest flyer on the entire planet, there was a certain level of respect that would be given to a Saipan, whether Dalus deserved it or not. People would look at Dalus and say, "Ah, look at how well he trained this magnificent guard." And there were other perks as well. Even in my station in the engineering branch, I'd heard stories of older, wealthy members of the LDC betting on guard races and other trials. If he played his cards right, Dalus could make a hefty profit off of my brother. So he pushed Zane to the brink, always insisting that he could fly faster, farther, for longer periods of time. And then it happened. I'd been at one of the Council's airstrips working on improving navigational systems in the newest ship models when I found out. An LDC higher-up I'd never met before was the one who told me. I remember seeing his tan robes as he stepped out of his transport and knowing something bad had happened, that he was there to see me. "It was an accident," he said. "Zane was performing long-distance training. He was flying at incredible speeds, far faster than should have been allowed. There was a Kabarok supply ship coming into the city. We don't think Zane saw it until it was too late." At first, I didn't understand, until the man started telling me something about how Zane's training band, the one that tracked his speed and location, went dead, and that something had to have brought down that ship. They were still trying to excavate the site where it crashed, but they wanted me to know as soon as possible. They wanted to tell me that my brother was dead. "Again," the man said, "we're sorry for your loss. It was a terrible accident." The minutes that followed were a blur. I just kept thinking that there had been some kind of mistake. Zane wasn't gone. He just ditched his training band and was hiding in the clouds somewhere. It was a joke. My beautiful, smart, talented, loving baby brother was still floating up there in the sky somewhere. Zophie had been at the airstrip. She'd been there for some other LDA matter and tried to calm me down. But I don't remember what she said. I couldn't hear anything but my own thoughts, shouting at me over and over again. "You just have to find him." I wanted to run and scream and fight and cry. What I ended up doing was climbing into the cockpit of a ship I had no permission being in and taking off. It was the first time I'd flown alone, but the system was advanced and did most of the work for me. I knew how to take off and engage the autopilot because I'd helped design updates for the navigation system. And before I knew it, I was soaring through the air, looking for Zane. I had no idea where he'd been training, but it didn't matter. I just couldn't live with myself if I didn't try to find him. Eventually, exhausted, I landed somewhere out in the country. LDA officials tracked the stolen ship and brought me back to campus. By that time, they'd finally located Zane's training band at the crash site, and his remains. I wanted to see Dalus, to tear into him, but they wouldn't let me near him. Eventually, he was shipped off to a remote Kabarok. No one would tell me where. He must have gone completely off the grid. I never found him. I tried to stick it out at the academy, but it just seemed so pointless now. People kept using the word accident, as if it was supposed to make things better. Then, for the first time, I started thinking about how truly messed up Lorien was, how tenuous our freedoms were, and how our leaders were never held accountable for anything. Not really. What if Zane hadn't been forced to go to the LDA, to be trained to fight and protect? What if he'd just been allowed to be a normal kid? What if he'd had any choice of his own in the matter? or if the LDA had listened to me when I told them Dalus wasn't a good match for him. Accident. That word hit me like a sucker punch every time it was spoken. Because what happened to my brother wasn't an accident. There were people to blame, Dalus being the most obvious, but the LDA as well. And I couldn't forget the elders who had ruled that our society's most gifted children must be trained as soldiers based on a prophecy that I didn't even believe was true. Not then. And me too. I was to blame for buying into all this, into the idea that the LDA and LDC would keep Zane safe, that they had our individual interests in mind instead of their own. I couldn't handle hearing the word accident anymore. I left the academy. I never returned. In my tiny little room on the ship, I can't get Zane out of my head. It's been 5 years since he flew too fast to the sky, and even though I know he's gone, there's still a part of me that expects him to randomly show up and re-enter my life. Losing Zane left a hole in me. It's for this reason above all others that I tried to stay free of too many responsibilities these past few years, people included. I couldn't get close to anyone, couldn't even say goodbye to our grandfather. I refused to be hurt again like I was by Zane's death. If that meant I'd be alone for the rest of my life, so be it. Only now do I realize that some of my assumptions about Lorien and the way it was run were wrong. The prophecy was real. We needed soldiers. Some of the guard even saved my life. But at what cost? Lorien is most likely gone, burned away. And if Zophie's intel is right, the elders only saved 18 citizens, 19 if you count Janus. Why them? What makes them so special? What makes them more worthy of saving than me? Or Zophie and Creighton and Ella? Or Zane? Chapter 7. The weeks wear on. The Chimerae adapt faster than we do. I suppose that's the story of their lives, though, changing to fit the present situation. They are mostly small, furry animals now, rodents hibernating in storage bins. They seem to know that there's not enough food on board for both us and them to survive, and so they sleep away the days. Creighton spends too much time watching over them, stroking their backs when Ella is napping. Every few days he wakes them up one by one and goads them into drinking a bit of protein-based slurry pressed out of a little gold pouch. I hope that we make it to Earth before I have to know what the gray globs that fall out of that package taste like. At first, we talk a lot about Lorien, positing theories and asking the same unanswerable questions we'd had when we could still see the planet's scorched surface through the portholes. We spend hours trying to come up with answers we can't confirm. Everything is hypothesis, conjecture. We don't even know the status of the planet itself. It doesn't take long for us to realize that we're having the same conversation over and over again, and without any of us having to say it, we make a conscious effort to keep our focus on the future. The time for answers will come when we're on Earth, when we can track down Janus and the evacuated guard in Saipans. They'd be taking a different course than us, given their ship's capabilities. They'll be on Earth months before we are. Zophie won't entertain the idea that anything will happen to Janus's ship on its journey, or that the Mogadorians tracked or intercepted it. Creighton seems just as determined to believe that the others will be on Earth too. I think he feels unprepared to raise Ella, which is something I can't blame him for. If she ends up a guard like her parents, she'll need a mentor Saipan to train her, and there are likely only 9 of those left in the universe. I try to remain optimistic that the other ship successfully escaped the Moogs and will make it to Earth unharmed. There are so many questions I have that only the chosen survivors can answer. Maybe Loridas himself is with them, and I can pin him down and ask him why. Why, after all our training, we weren't ready.
why the Moogs came for us, why so many had to be sacrificed. Finding the others once we're on Earth, though, that's going to be the real challenge.
Zophie had enough foresight to bring a data pad from the museum with her, and so over the course of our months in space, she gives us a crash course on Earth, trying to acclimate us so that when we get there, we don't stand out too much. The planet hasn't made contact with any extraterrestrial life, at least not that they know of, and Zophie is unsure of how they might react to the discovery that they're not alone in the universe, perhaps with hostility. But blending in ends up sounding much more difficult than I had expected it would be. On Lorien, the customs and cultures didn't really change much, whether you were in the middle of Capital City or shoveling Chimerae dung at a Kabarok. But Earth appears to be nothing like that. It's so much bigger and split up into different sections that are all so different from one another. There's no ruling body directing all the planet's people, or humans as Zophie calls them. That sort of diversity sounds great in theory. It sounds like the kind of world I always imagined Lorien might turn into if we just opened our eyes. But as someone from another planet, it makes trying to get a grip on humans pretty damned difficult. Fortunately, we have a lot of free time, so learning about Earth is at least a distraction from the monotony of our journey. Not to mention the anxiety of watching our food store slowly dwindle. By Zophie's calculations, we should make it to Earth just fine, but we all start eating smaller and smaller amounts of food as the months progress. We survive on dried caro fruit and protein chews. Zophie insists we try to have a rudimentary knowledge of several languages before we land, enough to ask simple questions and sound like tourists or travelers from other Earth realms instead of three people who can't speak a single Earth dialect. Again, I'm astounded by how different the people who all inhabit the same planet could be. How strange that these billions of people can't even all communicate with each other. We start with a language called French, as its vowels are most like our native Loric tongue, then switch to others I've never heard of. Spanish, then English, and then Mandarin. Creighton and Zophie excel at the languages, and before long, they are laughing at jokes in one known as German, while I'm still stumbling over Ich heiße Alexa. This is probably because I spend most of my free time writing down everything I remember from my days working on Earth's communication systems instead of studying new languages. I am more at home with the vocabulary of electronics, ones and zeros, and carefully formatted lines of code. Based on my time at the LDA, I assume Earth has reached a point in its technological evolution that means it's interconnected by machines and relying on them in the same way we were on Lorien. The internet was one of the many gifts that the Loric brought to humans over the centuries. Not that they know it, or that any of the other treasures we bestowed on them actually came from us, or even that some of their brightest minds were not of their planet at all, but Loric. I used to wonder why we'd spent any resources helping a planet so far away when there was nothing in it for us, not even recognition of our contributions. But now I'm beginning to wonder how long the elders knew about the Mogadorians, how much of the secret war was real. Had they been preparing for a Loric migration to this new world this whole time? 6 months into the trek, I find Creighton hyperventilating, sitting on the ground beside the makeshift crib we've put together for Ella, an oversized plastic bin fastened to a side table and filled with blankets. Creighton's face is white, and his forehead is shiny with sweat. "What's wrong?" I ask, taking a few quick strides to the baby's side. But she's fine, sleeping without a care in the universe.
"What am I supposed to do with her?"
he asks.
"I watch over animals. That's it. I just make sure they have food and water and aren't sick. I don't know how to raise a child."
I stare down at him. I'm not sure if he really wants an answer or if he's just talking to himself. He continues.
even after all our studies. I feel like I hardly know anything about Earth. How am I supposed to make sure she's okay? What language am I even supposed to speak to her in? Lorik? And what if she asks about her parents? What am I supposed to tell her?
I glance towards the cockpit, where Zophie's lost among the stars, staring at everything and nothing at once. I guess this is something I'll have to handle on my own. You'll tell her whatever you want, I say.
That's a great bedtime story, he scoffs. That her mom and dad are most likely dead, and that they sent me with her on a ship with a bunch of animals to make sure she was safe. How do you explain that to a little girl?
I don't know what to tell him.
What I'd tell Ella. What would I tell Zane?
My first instinct is the truth, without question. But what if the truth is terrifying? How do you find the middle ground? What if the truth puts her in danger?
Maybe you don't explain it, I suggest. Maybe you tell her something that will help to keep her alive and safe, even if that means lying to her.
You'll have to ask yourself if her knowing the truth is more important than her being able to fall asleep without the fear of everyone she knows being destroyed in a hail of fire in the middle of the night. Creighton looks up at me. His eyes are bloodshot.
I'm not going to lie to her, he says.
Ella starts to wake up, stretching and cooing. Creighton is on his feet in an instant, bent over her. I shake my head. When the time comes, I say, you'll do what you have to in order to protect her. I leave him with the baby and retreat to my room. Chapter 8. By the time we have a visual on Earth, Ella has a full head of auburn hair. The rest of us are looking unkempt. Creighton sports a bushy dark beard that hangs almost to the middle of his chest. There's a puff of black hair an inch thick on my own head. Zophie keeps her long red locks tied back with a piece of cloth. Actually seeing our destination is reassuring, as we're starting to run out of supplies. Without ever talking about it, we've all been doubling down on rationing, and the result is three gaunt Lorik with dark circles under their eyes. Ella is the outlier. She's practically chubby, which leads me to believe that Creighton has been giving her some of his own food. Not that I mind. The girl can stand now, and will run a little if we're not careful. The ship wasn't really made with children in mind, and it's full of sharp corners. She can even say a few words, maybe more than a few. It's hard to keep track of whether she's making gibberish noises or trying to form words in one of the languages we practice. She definitely knows our names, at least, even if she does struggle with some of the consonants. We have become X, Zoe, and Rayan to her, the last of which is the strangest to hear coming out of her mouth, since it could just as easily be her trying to pronounce her father's name. But there's no denying that it's Creighton she's calling for when she wakes. Her eyes light up whenever she sees him. And for his part, the way he looks at her has begun to change. No longer is it only with worry, like she's a fragile bubble he has been tasked with protecting. That's still there, but under a thick layer of affection. When I call everyone to the cockpit to see Earth, even though it's only a blue pinhead in the distance, Creighton brings Ella with him.
You see that?
He asks her, pointing into space.
That's our new home. That's where you're going to grow up.
She just coos and pulls on his beard with chubby little fists. It's a few more days before Earth looms large ahead of us, and we can discuss where and how we're going to land. We don't exactly have the luxury of time or travel, as we're coasting on the fumes of synthetic fossil fuels by this time. Based on our angle of approach and the rotation of the planet, we have a very narrow window of where, geographically, we might land. We're so low on power reserves that we'll be relying on the force of Earth's gravitational pull to bring us down to the ground as it is. Zophie pores over scans from Earth's surface, seated in the co-pilot's chair.
Finally, she points to a spot on the digital map she's pulled up on one of the cockpit monitors.
There, she says. It's a desert.
So, lots of sand? I ask. It takes a few seconds for me to understand what this means, since deserts weren't exactly abundant on Lorien.
Right, and more importantly, it's largely uninhabited, so we won't have to explain where we came from to a bunch of bystanders. We'd be able to set the ship down and journey a day or so to a major metropolitan area, a city called Cairo.
I bring up the coordinates on a navigational panel. It looks like that's doable, I say. Tell Creighton he needs to strap down with Ella. When we enter Earth's atmosphere, things will start to get bumpy. The three of us remain quiet as we start our final approach to the planet. Even Ella is silent, as if she realizes that this is important. I keep my eyes locked on the instrument panels, monitoring the increasing heat outside, as we shoot through the atmospheric bubble.
This isn't so bad,
Creighton finally whispers.
At least there's not a fleet of ships hovering around.
The ship begins to shake violently, shutting him up.
Is everything?
Zophie starts.
We're fine.
I keep my eyes moving back and forth between the instruments and the quickly approaching surface of the planet in front of us. The ship continues to jostle back and forth as if it's trying to tear itself apart in the sky, but it holds together as we sail head first towards a golden expanse of land. A readout from one of the monitors beeps. It's time to deploy our re-entry measures. A dozen outboard thrusters that will rapidly slow our descent until we're hovering above the sand.
Hold on!
I shout and flip the switch. Only nothing happens. I hit the switch again. And then again. Still, there's no response.
Shit,
I mutter. My heart and brain begin to race. Shit.
What is it?
Creighton asks. The re-entry thrusters aren't working. We're traveling too fast. We have practically no fuel. There's no way we can eject ourselves at this velocity. Alarms and warnings start to go off around the cockpit. I tap on the controls until I'm given a readout that helps explain what's going on. We never properly rebuilt the thrusters during the restoration. I've got two front thrusters I can engage, but it's a one-time deal, and they'll only change the direction of our much too rapid descent slightly. We're going to crash. Somewhere behind me, the Chimerae shriek, and Ella cries as the cockpit instruments make terrible whining noises that seem to say, "It's too late, you're dead." I try to remain calm, going over options in my head. There's nothing we can do, not even a re-entry parachute we can deploy. And then suddenly an image comes to me. Zane. His favorite way to scare me after he developed flight was to race towards the ground until I was screaming for him to slow down, to stop, always sure he was going to end up crashing into the lawn or street. He'd wait until the last conceivable second and then finally pull up, shooting past me horizontally or tornado in the form of a little boy.
Everybody, get ready, I say. I'm going to try something.
I hear them shout things at me, but I don't listen. I have to be completely focused. We're getting closer and closer to Earth. But I wait. I have only one chance at this. We have only one chance. The sand is almost upon us now. Zophie screams. Creighton wraps his arms around Ella. I punch the front thrusters. We straighten out for a split second until we're parallel to the Earth. That's when I blow the last of our fuel in one hard boost straight ahead. It works. By some miracle, we don't crash. Not exactly. The surface of the desert is a blur as we skim across it. We start spinning. I'm sure that at any moment the ship is going to break in half and send us spilling out, our bodies breaking against the sand. But it stays together long enough to smash into a giant dune. Sand covers us, blacking out the cockpit, but for the still beeping emergency lights. Everything is calm except for the howling of the animals. And the child, Ella, cries.
I'm almost afraid to look away from the controls or let go of the flight yoke. And then I hear Zophie gasping for air and Creighton talking to Ella, and I know that they're alive. I look at them. They glisten with sweat and their eyes are wide, but they're okay. I hadn't even realized I'd been holding my breath, but I exhale finally, peeling my shaky hands off of the controls.
You did it,
Zophie says, and I can't help but laugh a hysterical, confused laugh as I try to gulp for air. Chapter 9. Getting out of the ship proves to be a challenge. The only way we're able to escape is thanks to Raylan's weapons cache, one of the few boxes we haven't touched in the year and a half of our journey. My landing might have kept us from crumpling against the earth, but it also deeply embedded us in a sand dune. The loading door is blocked, and without any fuel to punch the thrusters or engine, it's impossible for us to dig ourselves out of the sand. After a little bit of brainstorming, I find an old incendiary grenade in one of the boxes from Lorien and blow a hole in the side of the cargo bay while we huddle in Creighton's living quarters, along with the Chimerae. On one hand, it's perfect that we've crash-landed in the middle of nowhere with no humans to catch sight of us. On the other, seeing nothing but sand and dunes surrounding us isn't the most welcoming sight imaginable. How's the radar on Earth? I ask, as I jump down into the hot sand, wearing the t-shirt and black pants I had on the night everything changed on Lorien. They're a little baggier on me now, but I hardly notice. It is so good to be breathing air that hasn't been recycled, and to feel sunlight beating down on my skin. I don't mind the heat. I welcome it, just as I welcome the solid, stable ground under my feet. Their systems aren't exactly unsophisticated, Zophie says, climbing out through the smoking hole. It's possible someone caught our entry. We're in northern Africa, Egypt. We're close enough to their capital that they may have had eyes in the sky.
Can someone take her?
Creighton asks, and then he hands Ella down to Zophie. Soon, the three of us stand at the top of the dune our ship has crashed into. The sand stretches out for what seems like an eternity.
Which way do we go?
Creighton asks. He's now got Ella strapped to his chest, holding his hand over her head to shield it from the sun.
I'm not sure,
Zophie bites her lip. I was charting us visually from space once we were close enough.
Isn't there something on the ship that can point us towards civilization?
None of our tech is made to work with the satellites here, I say. I might be able to reconfigure something, but I have no idea how long it would take.
If the humans tracked our entry, they might be coming this way.
Zophie raises her hand to her eye, squinting.
Then we should move, I say. Try to find a populated area and blend in.
There's some kind of commotion below us, and I realize that the Chimerae have all flown out and are now stretching their bodies, morphing between shapes and wrestling with one another in the sand. They seem as happy as we are to be outside again. A few of them take avian forms and soar up in the air.
I've never seen them so riled up,
Creighton murmurs. They should get it out of their systems here, I say, while we're out of sight. I can't help but wonder, what are we going to do with all these beasts now that we're on Earth? One of them, a giant blue bird, flies higher than the others, golden eyes shining like a beacon in the sky. It lets out a shrill call and then swoops down, looping around us in two tight circles. It flies so close to me that I can feel its wake in the air on my face. Then the animal is in the sky again, beating its wings against the wind, but looking back at us.
Did I go completely insane in space? Or is that Chimera beckoning for us to follow it?
Zophie asks.
Possibly both, I say. Her name is Olivia, Creighton says. She's always been one of the brightest among them.
He turns to us.
I think we should follow her.
Zophie and I exchange glances.
She shrugs. That direction looks as good as the others. Before we leave, I take a closer look at our ship, or what's left of it. Even without the gaping hole we've blown out of the back hull, the main propulsion units look like they were fried in our reentry. Without the necessary parts and materials, there's no way the vessel is ever moving again. I think this ship's seen its last flight, I say, suddenly feeling very much stuck on this new planet.
So do we just leave it, or what?
Creighton asks. Zophie suggests we blow it up if we don't want the humans to find it and suddenly come face to face with the realization that they're not the only intelligent life in the universe. I can't tell if she's joking or not, but either way, I argue that it's a bad idea. I'm not exactly thrilled by the thought of destroying what might be one of the few remaining Lorik computer systems in the universe. Besides, the ship is almost completely embedded in the sand dune anyway, obscured. After a few days, it will likely disappear beneath the sand completely. So we gather the few supplies we still have and distribute them among bags for equal carrying weight. There's little food and only a handful of weapons, knives, concussion grenades, and a few blasters. Raylan didn't skimp on other resources, though. We split up the jewelry, rings, bangles, necklaces, and precious stones. We walk. It is perhaps the first time that the enormity of our situation has dawned on me. We are now refugees. Four beings without a planet. We are a species on the brink of extinction, trusting the guidance of an animal because we have no better plan or option. Even though Earth has been our intended destination for months, being on its sandy ground feels surreal. It feels so foreign. It's been so monotonous on the ship that I've let old fires grow cold. But now that we're on Earth, I remember all the hatred I had for the way Lorien was run, and for how it fell. I silently curse the names of each and every elder. It's something I've done countless times, usually thinking of Zane. Or for the Lorik who died in the Moog attack, even those who were a part of the system, whether they realized it or not. At this moment, though, with the child crying and our feet sinking into the sand, I curse the elders for me, and Zophie, and Creighton, and Ella. For everything they might have kept from us. For getting us into this situation. For thinking that we weren't worth saving. We follow Olivia. The rest of the Chimerae trail behind us. Eventually, when our pace slows, a few of them transform into four-legged beasts and carry us and our supplies. We march on until they too begin to grow weary, and then we camp. Night falls. Zophie guesses that it must not be summer or winter, otherwise the temperatures in this climate would be extreme. It's chilly, but we make do. One of the Chimerae morphs into a large animal with long, soft fur, and after a little hesitation, I give in to leaning on it. I fall asleep quickly, my mind drifting to other times. Zane and I playing games at our grandfather's home, our mutual excitement on his first morning at the academy. Perfect afternoons on Lorien. It's the middle of the next day before we spot structures in the distance. Tall, sand-colored triangles jutting out over the horizon. When Zophie sees them, she cries out, running forward a few steps.
The Great Pyramids, she says. They're ancient constructions. One of the first projects the Lorik spearheaded here on Earth ages ago when we were still trying to assess the capabilities of the life forms here. This is it. The Chimerae led us in the right direction.
And so we soldier on with renewed vigor. A few hours later, we begin to pass small buildings and finally hit roads. The Chimerae shrink down to smaller sizes. Some scurry through the gutters as lizards. Others perch on rooftops above us as birds. I swear I see a small rodent crawl into one of Creighton's pockets.
We stand out, with our bags and sallow expressions. A few men congregated in front of what looks like a small market ask us questions in a language I don't recognize, but Zophie does. It must be one of the ones she studied on her own. She converses with them for a few minutes, finally laughing a little.
What is it?
Creighton asks in Lorik. I shoot him a look. That's not our language anymore, I say in French.
Zophie smirks. They say we look as if we just walked across the desert. They say that would be a long journey indeed.
Ask them where we can find a place to stay. She goes back to talking. The words come rapidly, and it sounds as if things are getting heated.
We're in Giza, she says. I told them we need to find a place to sleep, but they're trying to sell us a tour of some local landmarks. They think we're visiting from another place on Earth.
I take a few steps forward, scowling. I have several inches on these men, and when my boots plant in front of them, I can feel their apprehension. I reach into my pocket and remove a small glittering ring from Raylan's stash, holding it out to them in my palm.
Tell them it's theirs if they can get us to comfortable beds, I say.
Zophie speaks. The men grin.